Hello, and welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. The first thing I'm going to update you on is LQ Radio. After a short hiatus for the LQ Radio show, two episodes have been posted since the last podcast. The audio quality I think you will find in the show is greatly improved. The shows are now available via BitTorrent, and quite a few other improvements have been made. Both shows are about 90 minutes long, and we got a ton of feedback on the shows, and we are still looking for more. If you subscribe to the podcast and are getting these, but did not get those shows automatically, you're going to want to go to the site and unsubscribe from the current RSS feed that you're subscribed to, and subscribe to what's called the combined feed. The combined feed will get you all LQ Radio content, which ends up being this podcast, the LQ Radio show, and the LQ Radio interview series. On the note of the interview series, the next interview is scheduled for later this week and is with Asa of the Mozilla Foundation. We talked a bit about Asa on the first and I believe the second of the last two shows, and I also mentioned him on my blog a couple times, so stay tuned for that. Also on the LQ Radio note, a new streaming audio player is available on the site. If you go to radio.linuxquestions.org and click on LQ Radio Jukebox, that will allow you to stream the any of the podcast or LQ Radio content without an MP3 player even being installed on your machine. The one downside to that is that it does require Flash. You can still, of course, stream any of the shows via Icecast with MPlayer or XMMS, whatever MP3 player that you use. And, of course, the shows are also available, as I mentioned, in BitTorrent and via the podcast through the RSS feeds. So plenty of ways to get the content. Keep the feedback coming. If you have feedback on the show, feel free to either post it at radio.linuxquestions.org or email us at lqradio@linuxquestions.org. Next LQ update, LQ Bookmarks has been out of beta now for a couple of weeks, and it is going strong. Got some good exposure on the initial release, and there are already over 300 bookmarks entered. We have added a facility to the old bookmarks functionality at the main Linux Questions site to easily migrate your bookmarks one at a time. You're going to want to do that ASAP if you do use that section, because the old LQ bookmark feature will be turned off relatively soon, probably sometime in August. And for a reminder, for those of you that are not familiar with LQ Bookmarks, it is a new site that allows you to bookmark, tag, annotate, and share links to open source and Linux-related sites, and it does allow you to access your bookmarks from any browser on any machine anywhere, which is an added convenience. I posted recently on my blog a post called A Brief Look into LQ Visitors. Now, I would put LQ in the pretty big but not huge category as far as websites goes, which means more than 10 million views and less than 100 million views a month is the range that we're in. While many members are extremely new to Linux, the average visitor to LQ is certainly more technical than the average visitor on the web generally. You know, if you're looking at Linux and doing research into Linux or asking Linux questions, you're certainly more advanced than the average web user. And if you're answering Linux questions, then you're probably in, you know, the top 5% or so of a technical user. So this isn't going to be generally useful as far as extrapolating this information across the web, but I thought it'd be interesting to give you a view of kind of what the average LQ visitor looks like. The two things I broke down were OS and browser. As far as OS goes, you have Windows as number one at 52.2%, and this data was aggregated over about the last 30 days when I took it. I took about a 32-day snapshot just to get enough information to be, you know, fairly relative and consistent. So Windows was at 52.2%, Linux at 40.1%. From there, it falls down pretty rapidly. Unknown was third at 4.9%. And my guess, that's probably going to be mostly like online aggregators, things like Bloglines and Delicious, things of that nature. Macintosh was at 2%, BSD at 1%, and Solaris rounded it out at a third of a percent. So, you know, just the top two OSs there, Windows and Linux, were almost, 93%. So the top two certainly took by far the most percentage there. Moving on to browsers, the number one browser, and I aggregated Mozilla and Firefox into one, simplified user agent that got 57.7%. Drop down, the next one is Internet Explorer at 27.9%. And then once again, a huge dip after two, you go to Unknown at 5.2%. And I would assume that's mostly RSS readers there. Conqueror is next at 4.1%, Opera at 3.3%, Safari at 1.2%, and then getting at links at 0.3% and 0.2% respectively. Like I said, this will put us way on the outside on Outliner as far as normal, typical, and non-technical sites go, and even probably some technical sites. But just to notice how much of a lead that Mozilla and Firefox has. And I think if you look at the stats closely, you'll see that that lead is regardless of what platform you're using. And a good example of this simplified would be the Mac. A Mac, of course, comes with Safari, but just under half the Mac users seem to be using Firefox. And it seems like on the Mac, almost everyone uses either Mozilla or Firefox, or Mozilla Firefox or Safari. The amount of users that are on the Mac and not using one of those two was really, really small. So a lot of interesting info, I think, can be gleaned from the information there. A complete post of this is on my blog at jeremy.linuxquestions.org, and I'll leave some of the fun and number crunching up to you. Now on to the news. First story I have for you is more Linux on the desktop musings. This was sparked by a blog post by Aza that got slash-dotted, and as I mentioned, Aza will be on LQ Radio later this week. I talked to Aza in depth about this at GnomeDex, which was right about a month ago now, and this was discussed in both of the last two LQ Radio shows. As I said, I have to agree with some of what Aza said, and of course, as you probably guessed, I don't agree with all of it. But I do think that when someone like Aza, who clearly not only really, really gets open source, but he promotes open source for a living. So when he talks about something like this, I think it's in all of our best interests to listen. And from my perspective, and if we could put application and driver support aside, and I know this is a huge issue for Linux, and I don't want to minimize it, and I think it's absolutely one of the most important things that we have to face, and probably the biggest shortcoming. I'm going to put that one kind of to the side, admit that it's a shortcoming, and say that it's being worked on, and I'm going to address some of the other things. I'd say that Linux is almost as ready for the desktop as Windows is, and the issues that many people have is that it's different, and not really ready or better or worse, but just different from what they know. They don't want to really take the time to learn a different operating system. They have, you know, an invested time interest in Windows. They've learned it. They know it. They probably don't know it exceedingly well, but they know it well enough that they're comfortable. So when you put them in front of something different, regardless of if that something different is better or worse, they just feel kind of uncomfortable at first, and they don't want to give up that time investment that they had. But if you do remember far enough back, if you're a Windows user, you did have to learn Windows at some point. And if you can honestly think back and think, when you first sat down in front of a Windows machine, did it seem more confusing than now? I think that you'll find that Linux is probably almost as logically laid out, in some places definitely more logically laid out than Windows is to a new user. The next issue that I hear kind of a lot about Linux is that the install is too hard. This one I definitely think is incorrect. Linux is at least as easy or easier to install than probably almost any operating system, definitely including Windows. The thing here is, most Windows users have actually never installed Windows. It came installed, pre-installed with the machine when they bought it. And I think some people just assume that it must be easy because so many machines have it. But I think that perception is more a function of Windows being pre-installed on pretty much any machine you can buy than anything else. Another issue I see talked about is that to get anything done in Linux, you have to edit all these text files and drop to the command line all the time. And I don't think that this is true any longer, although it certainly once was true. And while I still prefer to do things in the command line, I think it's much easier and you can do almost anything quite a bit quicker than opening up a GUI tool and going through multiple content boxes. And for my choice, I would rather edit a text file. But these days, almost anything can be done through a GUI tool. And the good thing is, at least in Linux, you have a choice. And the other thing that I think gets ignored is the few things that you probably can't do in a GUI tool in Linux, you probably have to do like a registry edit or something else in Windows anyway. There are things in Windows that you can't do through the GUI also, but the amount of choice you have in Windows is much less, I'd say, than the amount of choice you have in Linux. Now, don't take all these previous comments as that I don't think Linux has a long way to go, because it definitely does. Aza and, of course, some others in the past bring up some very solid points, and you know, I could definitely add to the list as far as things and shortcomings. But some Linux advocates seem to have blinders on in this regard, and I do think that that's bad for everyone. In the end, though, I think some people give Windows way more credit for being easy than it deserves. And there's kind of seems to be a legion of quote-unquote power users that know how to do a couple of things in the GUI or maybe make a couple of registry edits here and there, and they don't fundamentally know what they're doing behind the scenes, so I think when they get to Linux, they're a little bit lost because they knew what to do in the GUI, not what to do technically. So Linux does require you to learn a little bit more, but the reward is a more solid, more stable system that's logical in design and efficient in operation. So once you understand the underlying paradigm of how Linux works, everything just makes sense from there. And if you need to learn how to do something a little bit different, it's usually taking a concept and just kind of applying it in a different way. Where in Linux, Windows, it seems a lot of things are kind of no rhyme, no reason, and there isn't very much of that in the Linux world. I consider that initial learning curve that is much admitted that Linux has is kind of like getting your permit when you get a car. Without that step, having a driver's license would be much more dangerous, and which is probably why there's such a high percentage of cracked Windows machines that are turned into spam-spewing zombies these days. Like I said, you can look forward to much more, I'm sure, on this in the interview with Asa. Next story, more on the Apple moving to Intel. And this story's getting a little bit old now, but I haven't done a podcast in a little while, and the topic just continues to get an amazing amount of press. The one article that I saw was on Ars Technica, and made a point about this that I hadn't really thought of, and that is Apple can now move to a single manufacturer for all of its products by putting Pentiums, you know, in the Macintosh and right down to the iPod, which can now run in X-Scale. And while they are putting all their eggs in one basket, Intel's a pretty big basket to put your eggs in. And I think the fact that the laptop G5 was so continually delayed probably didn't help, but I don't think that that was a deciding factor. You may be wondering why Apple would need something as powerful as an X-Scale for the iPod, and I have seen some rumors about a quote-unquote PSP killer, the PSP being the PlayStation portable device from Sony. Would be a cool device. I don't know if the market's really there. The market for mobile video is certainly much less than the market for mobile audio. I mean, you can use an iPod listening to music while you're pretty much doing anything, be it working or running, walking, driving. There's not much you can't do while listening to audio. The amount of things that you can do while watching a TV or watching a video, whatever, is obviously much, much less. Definitely not something you should be doing driving or probably not something your employer would want you to do while working. It's more something that you're going to see for frequent travelers or people who use public transportation, things like that. Most people are going to want to watch movies, you know, on their HD TVs at home with the surround sound and all that. Now, I don't want that. The addition to video to the iPod, I think, would be really great, and there'd be a lot of cool applications, which kind of brings me to another thing that I hadn't thought of is, if you think of what's one thing that Intel has that IBM didn't, and that's DRM at the chip level. Intel's all over DRM at the chip level, and IBM really wasn't. So surely if Steve Jobs and Apple want to get the MPAA and the others in Hollywood on board to doing a video iPod where you could download full movies, DRM's going to be huge there. Probably more DRM than's already built into iTunes, which is kind of scary. So now they have that DRM built right in. And think about it, it's a win-win situation. Apple gets that, And Intel finally gets a manufacturer who'll be able to showcase a cool x86 box. If you remember back, they had that Mac Mini lookalike that was just an empty box. Because there's not really a manufacturer out there making really cool, slick, fun x86 boxes. So Intel can now look forward to that. I have seen a couple of reports that this surely spells doom for the PowerPC platform. Definitely don't think that's true. IBM uses the Power, which is at this point the same instruction set as the PowerPC, in way too many places and way too many extremely expensive places. And the PowerPC is going to ship, to my knowledge, in all three of the next major consoles. And just those consoles alone, you're probably talking a rough guess, and this is just a guess, but probably in the order of 150 million or so units shipped, aggregated across all three of the major consoles. And when you compare this with the number of Macintoshes that will be sold over that same time period, you know, obviously the number of Macs is minuscule. So the number of PowerPCs in the end that this is going to affect units shipped is not going to be something that's going to cause the end of a chip. And one place that I think the PowerPC chip could be huge, and that's China. China is obviously a humongous population where the average person doesn't quite yet have a computer, and IBM's former PC division just happens to be owned partially by the Chinese government now, you know, when it got sold to, I think it was Levanto. So if they could come out with a cheap, nice PowerPC machine, maybe running Red Flag, which is a version of Linux that they have over there, I think that would be something that would have an extremely good chance for general adoption and broad acceptance. So we'll see if they're able to pull that one off. One last story I'll get into quick. We're going a little bit longer than I like to with the podcast. MySQL AB continues strong growth, best quarter to date. They today announced that they just completed the best quarter, and that was April to June, in the company's 10-year history. And this was due in large part to the success of its new MySQL network commercial subscription offering. This is, I think, a testament to the fact that the open source model is here to say it works. Companies are showing huge growth, and it's not just a philosophical or ideological thing. This is a business model that definitely works. And the subscription model, I think, is here to stay also. It's something that was kind of pioneered by Red Hat when they switched over to RHEL and RHN, which is their subscription service. And they're doing very well with it. And here's another example of a company taking that subscription model and doing exceedingly well. So congratulations to them, and I hope they continue to grow. They're a great company that makes a great product. And almost every one of the LQ sites, from the wiki to the radio site, to the main site, you know, we all run MySQL in the background, so thanks again to them. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening. And remember, if you like the LQ podcast, please head over to podcastalley.com and vote for us. Thanks.